sympathetic help from Eddie Bowen, who was the chief of the division. So that the group that had been working on radar was transferred to work on the new science of radio astronomy. There were quite a few, actually, who were dragged in from outside at this stage. Bolton and Paul Wilde were both been in the Navy, and also Slee, I think, no, it wasn't Navy, but they were all...
Air Force.
He was in the Air Force, that's right. They applied for jobs and they came joined the group. Fred Lahaney joined the group, and I did too. I was the only one who never worked on anything shorter wavelength than 13 metres, as I've been on the long distance communication. But because I was really the only one who'd done a lot of work on antenna design, I think Joe thought it was a good idea to have such a person in the group. In addition, in Australia, there was a small group. There was Clay Allen, who you all know in his textbook on astrophysical quantities, those of you who are interested in the thing, and D.F. Martin. And they were working, Martin became very interested indeed for a short time on this work. Well, the original work in Australia consisted of just daily measurements of radio flux from the sun at various wavelengths, and the wavelengths that were used depended on what the radar equipment available was. It went from 3 centimetres to several metres. And the early work was mainly concerned with the bursts of two things. One was the bursts of noise from the sun, the other was the day-to-day variations in the solar output. The equipment consisted mainly of radar aerials from 1 to 2 metres in diameter at shorter wavelengths, and slightly larger mesh paraboloids for use at 25 to 50 centimetres, and Yagis or arrays of them at the long ones. Could I have the first two slides, please? That's the typical one. I think that was the 3 centimetre one that Harry Manette and Jack Piddington were using. This one was one that I was using it at the time. Fred Lahaney was using it earlier, working at 25 centimetres. And it was an old radar antenna which we changed around to work on a polar axis. Previously, of course, it had just been rotatable one in azimuth. And that was really our first specially produced radio astronomy antenna. These things were used, as I'll talk about in a few minutes, for eclipse observation. Well, there were two things used. First, one was the timing of these bursts at different frequencies. This was considered by Joe to be quite an important thing. And the other one was to try to locate on the sun the position. Then the third group that Joe got going was a small theoretical group, Steve Smird and Westfold, to try to do a bit of interpretation of the work. Now, the first real discovery in Sydney resulted from the use of an antenna, which you all know about, but we'll have it on the next slide. Oh, this was Steve Smith, this was the theoretical group. As you see, Steve with his our only coloured photo, I think, of this series, with his famous machine, which kept everyone awake during our working hours, and crashing Steve's machine. The next slide, please. Now, I think I could ask Frank Kerr about this, but I don't think this was the original antenna.
First was a Yagi or a pair of Yagis.
Yes, and that was the one that was used. This was a later one, but it's on the same position as the first interferometer. And of course, it was a sort of Lloyd's mirror interferometer, using the sea as a reflection, and so it was a one of the first interferometric measurements in radio astronomy. And there were three people involved in this. There was MacCready, Horsey and Payne Scott. All of them are dead. Ruby Payne Scott died just a couple of months ago. And they discovered that from the fringes that during a big sunspot appearance, that the intense radio noise originated from a line across the sun in which this big sunspot group was present. In writing up the results, the authors made an interesting observation that if they could raise and lower their antenna, they would get a complete Fourier Fourier transformation. They would be able to get the radio brightness distribution across the disk. This was the first time in radio astronomy that aperture synthesis was mentioned. I think Ruby was responsible for that. Frank might like to make another guess at that. Yes, I think it was Ruby's idea. Well, now we'll return to the study of the emitting sources of radio bursts, we shall return to that later. But now turn to the study of the less active sun. Now, there were two groups interested in the changes in the daily flux of radio emission from the sun and the changes from day to day. One was Arthur Covington in Canada, and the other was the group in Sydney. And it was quite soon indicated that this steady output from the sun had two components. One was a base level below which the noise never fell, and the other one was a slowly varying component, which was correlated in some fashion with the area of sunspots, visible sunspots. And a lot of early work was done on that, and is still being done, of course. The relationship between sunspots and this slowly varying component which appears above the base level. The base level was found at 1.5 meter wavelength, was found to correspond to an apparent disk temperature of about 1,000,000 degrees. And this was a surprisingly high value, and D.F. Martin produced a paper showing that I won't go into a slightly scandalous thing concerning this, which you've probably heard of, but he explained this 10 million degree coronal temperature in terms of in fact that the corona was at a physical temperature of 1,000,000 degrees, and the other evidence from that, of course, was astronomical, that certain coronal emission lines could only be produced at very high temperatures, and also the widths of the lines correspond to that too. Well, Steve Smert and Kevin Westfold immediately got onto a model of the sun with a 1,000,000 degree corona, and calculated what the radio distribution should be across the solar disk at various wavelengths. And their paper, of course, their work of that early work is quite classical. It did predict that there would be limb brightening at certain wavelengths. Now, it was quite obvious, of course, that the resolving power that we had at those in radio astronomy at that time was quite pathetic. 2 degree beam width was considered marvelous, or 1 degree. And so several people in different places in the world started to scratch their heads as to what could be done about it. The first work, of course, had been this clip interferometer, and almost at the same time at Cambridge, Martin Ryle's group had used to antenna interferometer to try to get higher resolution. But in the solar field, there were two groups started immediately. One was Arthur Covington in Canada, and these are the two that I know of. There may be others that people would talk about here today. And ours was the other group. And in fact, I was the one who was mainly interested in getting high resolution in Sydney. Arthur Covington produced a long waveguide, slotted waveguide with to produce a narrow beam in one direction. And I produced a thing that was an analogue of the diffraction grating, although I didn't realise it at the time. Actually, I'd forgotten all about diffraction grating. Having worked in a radio factory for 12 years, I'd just about forgotten the physics by that time. It was the French who christened it a grating interferometer. I saw that term used first when I went to the Musée de la Découverte in Paris in 54. And to my surprise, there was a model of my grating there, what I call a multiple interferometer, labelled grating interferometer. That did produce quite a... we produced about 3 minutes of arc. I think we have a couple more slides for that. This is going back a little bit. This is going back. The first work we had, getting some feedback. Before we got onto the grating, there had been a little bit of work done on using eclipses, because you can get higher resolution as the moon goes across the sun. Arthur Covington had done the first, and he got quite a definite indication that the noise, a lot of noise, as we call it then, was coming from the sunspots. I then organised an expedition in Australia using three different locations so that we could get better than a one-dimensional scan of the sun. We could get locate the thing much better. Quite a few people were involved. I got Bernard Mills involved for his first effort in radio astronomy. He at the time was playing around with a linear accelerator and wasn't in radio astronomy at all. I said, we haven't got enough people, can you come and give a hand? So his first paper, the first time he had his name on it, he really wasn't a radio astronomer at all. This was the Sydney eclipse morning. Joe Pawsey was there, and Margaret, his daughter, both of whom unfortunately are dead, and his son. And Joe on that occasion was very anxious to come into the hut and watch what was happening during the eclipse. So I locked the door to keep him out, because he was a notorious fiddler. And I knew that if he were allowed near the receiver, we'd get no eclipse record at all. So poor old Joe was outside peering through the window trying to look at the chart recorder. Next one, please. This one was the eclipse, simultaneously the eclipse observation was done at 3 centimetres, that's the polarisation screen in front. That was done by Harry Manette and Jack Piddington and Jim Hyman. That of course is the thing for detection of circular polarisation. Well, now to get back to our first effort at getting high resolution, did I have the next slide, please? This was a picture, the first picture of our grating interferometer. You can see it wasn't quite finished. There are no feeds on the thing, but they came on very earlier. That was very cheap. I was allowed $6 for each dish, and that was just about the cost of the aluminium. However, we did it, and with the help of Keith McAllister, who was a good Scot and the most miserable designer I've ever met. In fact, I think we could say the reputation of radio physics depended and t- entirely on McAllister. It produced everything at about a tenth of the cost that anyone else estimated. It was quite a strenuous sort of a thing. We couldn't put motors on those dishes, of course, that was absolutely out of the question financially. So that they all had to be turned by hand. That thing followed the sun all during the day, and it was necessary to take a 25-yard run from one end to the other. So that every few minutes, we were all young and active in those days, of course, and we became even more so as a result of this. You had to sprint from one end to the other, giving it a hit at each area as you passed. Then you did have time to walk back and recover your breath before the next sprint. And this went on all day long. You can see there was quite an interesting thing in that it was working at 25 centimetres, and I couldn't afford to buy a coaxial cable, so I had to use open wire feeder lines, which is, of course, coming from communications, was the sort of thing I was used to. And I decided to use open wire feeder lines at 25 centimetre wavelength. And many a horse laughed at my colleagues on that. They said, you'll radiate anything from all the junctions that you're likely to collect. But however, it didn't work out. I made them very close together, and in fact, the open wire feeder lines gave extremely good results. They had a much lower thermal coefficient than the available coaxial lines anyway, so they were quite good. And the thing gave a very good result right from the start, and it became quite obvious that that on the sun there were the enhanced radiation, what we call the slowly varying component, came from the sun from regions of the plasma, usually in which there were sunspots. And that in fact all that was this level, this varying level, it was simply the result of a thickening of the corona over sunspots, and the corona being at a higher temperature than the lower levels, you were getting about 1,000,000 degree radiation from those levels, and this explained the slowly varying component. Now, at that time, of course, there was the 1952 IRSI meeting in Sydney, and I have got one slide of a similar group to the... Oh, sorry, that's the typical open wire feeder line. Can I have the next one then? That's got quite a lot more than the last one you saw, and I won't go right through it. La Finerva came the next of the IRSI chairman there of our commission. I think most of you can recognise the people there. Bruce Lee, La Finerva. I'll just go to surnames: Little, Payne Scott, Henry Brown, Muller, Slee, Smurd, Mills, Smith, Christensen, and that's probably enough for the moment. I just did the front top row. At this time this worked later. We had a visit from two young Indians who were completely raw. One was Parthasarathi and the other was Swaroop, and they joined our group. I won't tell any stories about them, because they're actually, on one occasion, Parthasarathi fell into the dam in the middle of the night. And he was fished out anyway by Govind, which was just as well, because you couldn't climb up the walls, they were so steep. And Govind was there with a rope and pulled that poor old Sati. He is working up in Alaska now, yes. And I must say this, I'll tell this story about Sati. First time day he arrived, we were very short of meters, and I was very, I had one I was very proud of, which was a 30 microammeter, which we used to in our observations. And the first sight of Sati was he appeared coming along the length of the aerial, dragging the 30 micro ammeter on the ground behind him on the end of the leaves. I wondered what had hit me, but he said, soon learned. So it's very soon. Could I have the next slide, please? We were getting, this was a sort of combination of daily measurements. Am I running out of time?
No, this is good.
You can see, this is several days measurements, and you can see the enhanced levels coming up as lumps on the sun. But what we were particularly interested in was the lower level. It seemed to be that there was a genuine lower level which had been predicted, which we call the base level from the sun. So I started trying to plot this base level to see whether it was genuine, and as it appeared to be, the first thing that was obvious was that it was nothing like a sine curve that you'd expect. It was flat, which meant that the sun, rather than looking at like a uniform disk at the lower level, looked like something that it might have been limb brightening, or it might have just been a bar. So I thought, well, we better build a second one in the north-south direction to scan the sun that way and see what it looked like. Well, we did that, and it turned out to be something quite sharp. And so it was quite obvious that there was something quite funny in the quiet level from the sun. And then one morning it occurred to us, thinking about it, and I thought, well, we are observing all day long, and the sun is turning round with respect to our coordinates during the day. I think we could synthesize the whole disk this way with two arrays. And so we measured the sun, took observations during the day. Actually, it was a very quiet period when these lumps were very small. And we continued this over 6 months, because during that time, of course, the position of the Earth's axis with respect to the sun's axis does change quite a bit. So that gave us an additional angle on the sun, and we proceeded to do the first two-dimensional Fourier transform upon the sun, the first one that was any good, and it was also the first use of the Earth's rotation to produce a picture. Can I have the next one? Next slide. That is the array of the two arrays, the way we had it next to the dam. Next one. And that's really the first, I think, picture of any celestial object, and it's also the first Earth rotational synthesis picture of any celestial object. Now at this stage, how many minutes? About three?
Yeah.
This stage, the people have asked me, why the devil we, as this was some 10 years before Cambridge boys were onto Earth rotational synthesis, why we didn't go on with it? Well, there was a very simple reason. We had no decent method of dealing with the results. It took the two of us, I think, 6 months with a hand machine to do the necessary Fourier transformation. And having done one, we vowed we'd never do another. So that we dropped it completely, and what we did after that was simply combined the two gratings in the form of a cross, and we did the things using that. I'm not going to say anything much about it. Could I have the next slide? Next one, please. That's it. And the next. And that's the sort of daily pictures. This week, you can see December 1957. So we were producing those at about that date, and that's the end of the period, so I won't say any more about that. Now, I have talked too long, so I'll have to cut down what I was going to say about it. Next slide, please. This is just some of the early work. Ruby Payne, Scott, Alec Little, Joe. Next. Now, Alec Little and Ruby were doing interferometric methods of using that on the sun and to locate the sources of burst radiation. And this work went on for quite a time, and they discovered some quite interesting things. First of all, they determined the height of origin of these noise storms above the disk, which was a very important thing. And they also discovered in apparent radial motions. So that it did appear that they were seeing things going out from the sun. And the radial velocities they found were 1,500, 600 and 3,000 kilometers per second for different outbursts. Now this immediately put Joe Porty onto the idea of getting a spectrometer and make a real job of it. And he gave the job to MacCready and to a very young fellow, Paul Wilde, to build the first one. And I'll just show the slides because I won't be able to say anything else. This was their first one. That was the young Paul Wilde taking a photograph of something. No, he's not. He's adjusting these are rhombic antennas. Next. And this is the array of rhombic antennas, three wavelength ranges for the spectrometer. You may recognize this fellow too. He's looking at the first equipment for the radio spectrometer. Next one.
It's interferometer.
Yeah.
It was interferometer.
Spectrometer.
Who was it?
Oh, that's
Sheridan.
Sheridan, yeah. And here they are looking at it in 52. Paul Wilde was a very thin man in those days. Next one. Oh, that's the lot. That's my time's up. Sorry, I had to rush over that last bit. Comments or questions?
No one from Cambridge here that wants to talk about the beginnings of aperture synthesis. It would have made it a little bit more lively. I think it's clear that the ideas were in the air, and it's very difficult to disentangle the who did what first, and what does it really matter in the end anyway. Okay. Yes, please.